Hello, everyone. My name is Herb Schellenberger, and I'm one of the programmers for Barrick Film and Media Arts Festival. And we're really excited to be showing in our 2021 festival the film Manifesto by Anayort Gutu. It's part of this year's New Cinema Awards, and it's the second film we've shown by Anna in the festival. A couple years ago, we showed a really excellent film called The Lost Dreams of Naoki Hayakawa. Manifesto, it really creates this kind of multifaceted portrait of an arts academy, which has been taken into a large national university. And through discussions with many different people, students, teachers, administrators, Anna touches on, you know, many seemingly disparate topics, from the connections between architecture and surveillance to those between neoliberalism and dysfunctionality. So Anna, you're an artist and a professor yourself. Before we touch on the film in particular, could you speak about kind of how these two roles inform each other for you and your experience as kind of a teacher practitioner?
Yes, I think for me, teaching has always been very present in my artistic work. So I started teaching actually just after graduating myself, and I got very interested in it. How to get a real contact with students, how to try to help them realize what they would like to do, to realize, and how to challenge or find new ways of teaching also, you know, new formats, new courses, new ways of thinking around what teaching can be. So I think that has followed me along the way, and I also made several films that in one way or another discuss educational situations. So I think actually contact with students and also other ways of teaching, like teaching, you know, young people, for example, 17, 18 years old, is very important for my artistic work.
Could you maybe expand that a little bit? What do you think it does? What does it provide to your work? Like, how does it maybe make you rethink or reframe things?
I think there are so many ways that it informs my work. I mean, firstly, when you're a professor, you're actually forced to, you know, keep in touch with what is happening right now. You have to read the texts that students are interested in. You have to understand their work. So you have to see new art. I mean, you have to actually be updated, which is incredibly important, I think, for all artists. But also, I think I am particularly interested in what kind of power relations that exist in this relationship between student and teacher, and other power relationships also within institutions. So I think that maybe there are some very crucial questions about power and about emancipation or freedom, and also about learning that that I work with all the time in various ways.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the course of the time that you've been teaching, could you perhaps characterize any trends in kind of university arts education in Europe, either, you know, either from students, from teachers, or, but like really also from like university structures?
You mean then like, artistic trends or more like institutional trends?
Maybe that's more what I'm talking about, like institutional tendencies or, you know, how have things been developing and changing? I mean, I know this is something you've researched quite a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, my impression is that we went from what we used to call a professor school, at least in Scandinavia. It was a school run by the professors, more or less. So they almost had their own schools within the school. They picked their students themselves. They had their own budgets and their completely own ideas of teaching and programs. So you were picked, when you applied to an art school, you were picked by one of the professors, and you were supposed to be in his, mostly his, class all along, all through your education. Mm-hmm. which then lasted 4 years. And you were not really allowed to switch professors. You couldn't really go to any other classes. And you were somehow stuck in that situation. And within that situation, there was a lot of freedom. Yeah, you know, that they didn't really care. As long as you delivered the work for the final grad show, you could actually just be there for 4 years and do whatever you wanted. So there were a total freedom and a total lack of, also, you could say, responsibility from the institution. Mm. And that changed a lot. So at least in Scandinavia, we got the Bologna process, and where we had to adjust to a certain standardized organization. Mm. I mean, the BA and the MA model. And then we got a lot of other types of control mechanisms. And some of them are really understandable, but in the end, they just, I think, became too much in a way. Like, there were too many different systems that were created to control staff and students. And parallelly, also, we got this new architecture around the education, which also contributes to a certain kind of surveillance, I think. So altogether, we have moved from a very specific old European art school model to a kind of new neoliberalist way of thinking around education, which I'm also critical to. So I'm actually critical all the way, but I think there was a chance maybe that you could do something in between there, which didn't really happen.
Mm. And it seems like the latter, which you discuss, is also kind of a more of an international model at this point. You know, it's something that is sort of standardized from country to country to some extent, or at least becoming so, it seems like. Yeah.
Yes, and of course, that's also logical. I mean, it's nice as well for students, for example, to be able to have a bachelor here and a master there, and that things are comparable. So I understand the logic behind that, but I think it could maybe have been done in a more flexible way, and this development could have maybe come more from the field itself, right, from the art field, because now it somehow comes from the EU and then from the politicians and then down to the field.
And so at what point did all of this thinking and all of this kind of like experience of teaching lead you to wanting to, you know, make this film about this topic in Manifesto? And also, you know, how did that idea of this particular film project kind of focus the research that you took before you went into production?
I mean, actually, I first visited the new Art Academy in Bergen in Norway, because they got this new building, which is like the most typical example of this kind of neo-corporative architecture that surrounds the art education. And I was kind of shocked, actually, by just being in this building, because it felt so overwhelmingly different from what I imagine as an art education. So that was one point where I was really interested in what had happened when they could build this building. And then I had this idea of a school hidden inside another school. And I guess that comes from also being an artist, because I feel that as an artist in an institution, you always feel that you are a little bit off, a little bit on the side, or you do things, but you feel that somehow what you do is not really what they want. So you always have this self-image of someone that is somehow subverting the institution a little bit. And I think this is almost like the image a lot of artists have of themselves in the society, right? So I wanted to combine this feeling of entering a completely new art educational institution, combine that with this image of this entity that is somehow playing with the rules somehow that they have, but then on another level, subverting it completely.
Mm. And keeping these kind of like radical practices alive in some way, whether that is through reshaping the architecture for their needs, or through, in one case, inviting the public in for like an open, you know, sort of an open workshop and stuff. Yeah. And so I think those points of the film are really evocative, where you see the actual artistic creation kind of fighting back against those limits that are imposed.
Yeah, and I think it's, I mean, a lot of these ideas for their projects, just they are very intuitive somehow, but I realized afterwards that, for example, they're all very, very much based on kind of, how do you say that, like essential experience, maybe, you know, it's music, it's this wool that they're touching, it's these mixtures that he's talking about on one occasion. So there maybe there is also this longing for something that is more grounded or more poetic, or that has some other quality than this architecture that they are surrounded by.
Mm. And can you talk a little bit more about your research process for this film? You know, I imagine conversations, you know, observation of, you know, yeah, buildings and classes.
Yeah, I have actually talked quite a lot with colleagues around in Europe to hear about their experiences in the last 10 years. I was also asked to write an article for a magazine called Kunstkritik, which has been widely read, actually, because I think a lot of these questions are very urgent for art academies around the world, actually. So my research was mostly about trying to figure out if this is a very local development or if it happens everywhere. Because I think there are certain local tendencies, but then there are also global tendencies in, that everyone knows about. So I think most of my research was about really trying to map whether this is representative somehow, and in what ways also people try to negotiate the rules or subvert the rules or just go below the radar. And that was also something I found out, that actually there are a lot of strategies for people, not only in art schools but in universities in general, to somehow bypass some of these regulations.
Mm-hmm.
Which they do all the time.
Yeah. And when we see that in your film, it can be, a really surprising but also sort of satisfying way that people are bypassing them. I mean, one of the things that I really love about your films is this kind of delicate slippage between, you know, reality and unreality. So even, you know, as I've seen, you know, several of your films before, the first time I watched Manifesto, I maybe it's a bit naive, but I read it as kind of a documentary. I was like, this is an actual school, you know. It only sort of dawned on me later that, you know, it's a fiction film that is comprised of these like slices of truth. And so how do you approach this kind of construction? And maybe I also am interested in like what you find fruitful in that kind of construction. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's naive, because a lot of people actually believe that it's true, and they want to believe it too. I think they get really happy when they see this school and, wow, great that someone is finally doing something. So it's, and they also get a bit disappointed when they realize that it's not really a documentary. I think the fruitful thing, I guess, for me is that it's, I just think it's more efficient in a way to stage it as if it's real. I think it reaches to people in another way, maybe gives a greater impression or a greater sense of actually imagining that it could be real when you see it. And I'm also so interested in this kind of interface between fiction and reality. I think actually, you know, I think that this division is very artificial in a way. It's, you know, somehow we're always traveling around within fiction, you know, dealing with them at the same time. And for example, I had an exhibition with this film where we exhibited this kitchen, you know, this kind of prop that we made, and we were projecting the film on the backside of the kitchen, and if you went around the kind of projection screen, you could actually open the kitchen and be in the kitchen. And then the different actors of the film had projects inside the kitchen. So they made food there, or they had a performance. And people were really somehow baffled, but in a good way, you know, when they could actually see the actors being artists in the exhibition space. So I think that they also got this idea that, wow, this is fiction, but it's also somehow real. And maybe that's what I'm interested in, that, you know, fiction could be real, or, you know, another world is possible.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that's part of, you know, yeah, for me, what's so enticing about the film, it's sort of like, it gives you this, you know, like a playbook that you could use, actually, you know, in the situations that you find yourself in these institutions. Because the thing about, you know, this film is, when someone like me watches it, you know, I'm not even an artist. I studied art history, and then I went to sort of an art school to do, you know, academic masters. But, you know, I recognize all of these things in it because they're so universal. I don't know. It's really touching in that way. You know, it really cuts close. You know, the people that I've spoke to who have watched this film have found their own identification in it, you know, and I think that's really special.
Mm. Wow, that's great to hear. You mentioned this term playbook. Is that really a kind of a thing? what is it?
it gives you maybe like when I use the word playbook, I think I meant gives you like strategies to use or something. It gives you like some examples of like how you could subvert these rules and get around.
I was just interested in it because someone asked why I called the film Manifesto, and why it has this text insert, you know. And I guess maybe playbook is an interesting word for me because it was a way to a manual, or, you know, whatever, something that can actually suggest ways to deal with this, which I find interesting and which I find more positive or maybe more constructive than just this complaining that professors have been doing now for 20 years, you know. We complain and complain about losing the kind of professorial power. And I think it's more constructive to actually suggest ways to deal with it, or ways to oppose or resist.
I was wondering if you could perhaps go a little deeper on this connection between architecture and surveillance in these kind of settings, in these sort of new or refurbished buildings. Like, I think about it also because I studied at Central St. Martin's, which is, you know, this industrial building that has been refurbished into this kind of open air glass, you know, on top of bricks thing. And, you know, so someone's always looking at you. And I always think about all of the tours they do of the prospective students there. And they're always sort of able to point and say, you know, this is them and this is what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I read this compilation of texts called Neoliberal Architecture. And among them is a text by Mikkel Bolt Rasmussen, who describes a new BMW factory in Leipzig, which is completely open and where all the workers watch each other all the time. And it's a fantastic spectacle to look at it. But and of course, it's somehow also a kind of freedom staged in this architecture, but at the same time, it's actually incredibly totalitarian, just because of this idea that everyone is watching everyone all the time. And I think in more or less, this is a typical feature of a kind of, yeah, what you could call a neoliberal architecture, where you're actually integrating the idea that everyone is responsible for everyone else and also for themselves. And I think for me in an art school, this is really critical, because the artistic process is so dependent from an artist being able to think and be alone and be free somehow to explore things, or be free to also make mistakes. So what I discovered, for example, in this building in Bergen was that the students were all the time aware that they could be watched, and therefore also somehow adjusted to it. So they were acting out a kind of student role. And they talked about it with me, that somehow they had been, for example, hammering. And when they were hammering, they felt that, wow, now I look like an art student at work. Because they knew that the hammering could be seen from above, and it could even be seen from below, because they also have kind of plexiglass in their floors. Yeah. So I think they were very aware that somehow they were taking part in this kind of art student spectacle that was going on in this building, and that they were really tired of it. But also that they weren't really, you know, you get tired in a particular way, I think. So you don't really understand where your tiredness comes from. You just feel that at the end of the day, you haven't really been completely immersed in your own thoughts or in your own processes.
I wanted to ask, perhaps it's a tangential question, but it's something that I've been wondering about as I've done like a little bit of teaching, you know, post my master's myself. And something that I've noticed kind of gaining increasing traction in art schools is things like zine making, but also things like noise music and things like this. People, you know, have a lot of different pedals and things. And these were things that, you know, I thought of as very like DIY practices that I feel like are being increasingly brought into the fold of, you know, like classroom assignments and things like make a zine based on this. When students are perhaps paying quite exorbitant fees to go to art school and doing things that they could maybe learn how to do themselves, or things that were maybe more vernacular, unruly practices. I'm wondering what you think about maybe those types of things being incorporated into curricula.
You know, I guess teachers are artists mostly, so they would like to incorporate what they are interested in. And I guess that's one of the reasons why all these things sooner or later end up in the curricula anyway. And I guess that's also completely fine, as long as, because I mean, things cannot always be underground, stay underground forever in a way. I think there are always creative new undergrounds. But I have the feeling, for example, that the rise of performance, which we have a lot of now, like people are really doing a lot of performance, might be a kind of reaction to this post-internet situation in two ways. Both that it's actually here and now, and you have to be there to see it, which is something else than sitting in front of your screen. But at the same time, it's incredibly Instagram friendly, so you can also somehow post it. And I think that trends within, you know, student activity or art educational institutions, they always go in both directions. They go to somehow free people from where they are, but at the same time confirm somehow, which I think performance is a very interesting example of, that you try to get free from the idea of marketing your work, because it's performance and it's not really market friendly, but at the same time, it's something that you can display, you know, in one way or the other. I just think that there are all these various forces working within these institutions.
Yeah, it's maybe hard to predict what forms they will, you know, take. The last question that I wanted to ask you was, what is your institution's reaction to the film being made?
You know, I actually feel that in that way, my institution has been incredibly generous and open. Of course, my fellow faculty members, they are super positive. We all feel more or less that this is something that we all know and that has been there. And we haven't really maybe discussed it so much, but it's there and everyone knows it. But I think also the administration accepts, of course, they have to accept that I use my freedom of speech and I can criticize it. But I also feel that they're interested, actually. And I got a lot of reaction from people also working in these administrations that it's not really that they want it to be this way either. I mean, they also want to be in an environment where people feel free and feel you know, in charge of a situation. So I think that also a lot of this development has happened without really anyone, that anyone really wants it, you know? And I must say I had a lot of interest in this film and also in this text that I wrote. I think that it's something there that people really want to discuss now.
Yeah. I guess just the more cynical side of me thinks that perhaps some of these changes sort of serve the increasing business interests of certain universities, like the University of the Arts London, I think is like perhaps one of the best examples. I do think that maybe... Though some of these consequences have outstripped any individual person's kind of ideas or ambitions, maybe in some cases they do serve the model of, you know, more students, more tuition money, like more pay for the people at the top.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, the whole point about a lot of these kind of regulations and requirements and reports and evaluations is just to give students, paying students, the idea that they get something, you know. If you had an art education like before, when nothing was really measurable and nothing was measured, then what do you get when you pay for your education? So I think, of course, that's a very big part of this, I think. If you have a spectacular building, it's easier to somehow also sell the environment and sell the programs.
We could probably talk about this for many hours, but I want to thank you, Anna, for the time to speak about Manifesto, and we're really excited to share it in this year's festival.
Thank you. Nice to speak to you, and I would have loved to come to Berwick, so I will consider it again if I can actually go there in person.
Great. Thank you. Talk to you later.
Yes. Bye.